Well, thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate it. This is quite an unusual biography where you have interspersed your true life story, some reminiscences about your father, and an awful lot about fishing. So my first question, I guess, is there any place in the world that you haven't been fishing?
Yes, but I'm planning to go there.
As I went through the book, I was jotting down some notes. I see, even during the war, in occupied France, you sought out a fishing hole.
Well, it's bad luck, I think, to travel anywhere without, you know, either your tennis racket or fishing rod or whatever it is that you like to do. And as a matter of fact, when I had a bit of bad luck in France and ended up as a guest of the Third Reich for 6 months, I didn't have my fishing rod with me. On the other hand, when I parachuted into France, I did, and came out of that business okay.
Well, I see you came into the CBS building today without your tackle. What happened?
Well, you know, I don't know. I have my tennis racket back at the hotel, and I hope to use it tomorrow morning. There's a slow period.
Well, I assume that your preoccupation with fishing, and of course there's an awful lot of detail about hunting as well, came from your father, who was quite an outdoorsman. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think I really owe him. One of the great debts that I have to him is for introducing me without pushing into fishing. As a matter of fact, he didn't even allow me to fish the first season I saw him fish, and I was allowed to watch him from the bank. I was a little boy. It probably would have been dangerous for me to try to wade in any case, but I built up such an intense desire to try it myself that when I did, I don't think I've stopped since.
How was your fishing as compared to your father? You know, some fishermen have a knack. You have two fishermen sitting side by side, and one guy catches all the fish, and the other guy catches nothing.
Right, and the fish comes up when you change places with a guy, and he says, "Where's your buddy?" You know. I think that I was a luckier fisherman than my father. I think that I became a better trout fisherman than him. He would always knew a great deal more about the sea and about ocean fishing than I ever will. And in fact, that's not my, you know, you like best what you're good at. Also, I got seasick.
Well, such a memory. I was making some notes here. See, way back in the 40s and 30s, you make reference to using a number 16 ginger quill, a 4X gut leader of 9 feet, an Andy Reeker flasher spoon with a 2-0 Siwash single hook. You actually remember all this detail?
Well, you know, certain things are very rememberable. The fellows I described fishing with in those days, in one case Pop Marks, in another case another one, Art Wood, this is what they fished with. I mean, you could ask anybody today who knew them, and this is what they always fished with. The flies are the flies that in those days were used. It was easy to check on myself to find out if I were right in those instances. The other thing was that, you know, delving into one's own past is, you know, the most fascinating subject in the world, of course, is oneself. Especially, you know, if you allow vanity to overcome you completely. But what is amazing is how the, you know, opening of one door opens another, and you really do suddenly have insights into the past that when I started this, I really had no idea how much stuff was going to appear and be absolutely lucid to me.
Well, you certainly detail your life in a way that I wonder how you were able to reconstruct it in the way that you did, because I can't remember details of my life. I remember highlights.
Well, just try writing it down sometime, and you'll be amazed at how, you know, things will come to you.
Is that the way you did it? Or
yeah.
Did you
I think I submitted a plan, you know, but then the plan went down the drain. I started to write a book of fishing recollections. And I suddenly realized I was working awfully hard to do a book that I wasn't really that interested in doing, and that I really wanted to write a personal memoir.
Mm-hmm. Is Misadventures of a Fly Fisherman your first book?
First book.
What is it like setting out to write a book knowing that your father was the eminent novelist of this period, it's kind of a shadow over your head.
More than a shadow, I think that if I'd undertaken to write fiction or to try to write like my father, that I would have been very foolish indeed. Any comparisons obviously would be odious. I want to avoid them at all costs. I don't want to step into the ring with the old man. I wanted to tell the story, and I hope I've done it reasonably well. I never thought about my father's style or anything else as I wrote it. I tried to remember how things really were.
Well, let's just give me a little summary about your life. You were actually born in Paris, weren't you?
No, I was born in Toronto.
That's right. Your father was working for the Toronto Star. Right. I remember that, yes.
Then, hated his editor.
What's that?
Hated his editor, who a fellow called Harry Hindmarsh, who actually bawled him out for coming directly from an interview with David Lloyd George and going to see my mother in the hospital where I'd just been born, pulled him out for going directly there rather than coming straight to the office and writing the story before going to the hospital.
Your formative years were spent in Paris, isn't that true?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What was that? Of course, you were very young. That was before your mother, Hadley, remarried and moved to Chicago. How old were you when you left to go back?
I was about 11 years old when we moved back in 1934. My mother and father were together with me as a child only until I was three when they were divorced. But my father continued to live in Paris for a while. And after that, I went to visit him in Key West and spent my summers with him and staying in Paris in the winter with my mother. I was very fortunate. It sounds funny to say I was very fortunate to have divorced parents, but I thought that kids who didn't have two sets of parents, who didn't get to travel across the Atlantic twice a year, were sort of underprivileged in some way.
So you did have a ongoing relationship with your father over the years?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What kind of relationship was it between you and your father?
Well, I think it was, it was a summertime relationship, put it that way. I was not there, with one exception, a full year when he was, when he was really working hard. My kid brothers would tell me, "Boy, you don't want to be around here when he's working, because in the morning we got to go away someplace. You can't make any noise and so on." But when I was there, he made a great point. Although he did do some work spending time with us and organizing, fishing or going up the Keys to hunt or our expeditions going out to Wyoming and Montana. The drives going out west in the early days, both before my younger brothers were able to join us and later on, are among my most pleasant memories of the times with my father.
What was it like carrying the Hemingway name? People, as you were growing up, come up to you and say, "Not the Hemingway."
Right. My brother Patrick, he says, when asked that question, he says, "It's kind of like being royalty without the responsibility." I wouldn't describe it that way. I think that in my own case, I wasn't really aware. I knew my father was special because he was big. He was good at a lot of things that I would like to have been good at. His importance as a writer wasn't the thing that I held him as a hero, as my own personal hero for. And I was really only aware of that, I think, at some point in prep school when my master, Mr. Borg, my English master, said, "This is not a very good paper, Hemingway. What's your, you can do better than that." And I said, I don't think I can. This is I saw Billy Gibson's paper, and it was certainly no better, and you gave him an A. He says, yes, Hemingway, but you're expected to do much better work. And I suddenly realized, why.
you were went to Dartmouth just before you entered the military, and your military career is kind of interesting. Give me a thumbnail sketch of that.
Well, it started, you know, in the standard way, and I ended up going to OCS. And
even during OCS, you were fly fishing up in Michigan.
Well, I did. Before OCS, I hadn't been able to keep a rod with me during basic training. That was a little bit too far. But just the approaching imminence of that's a redundancy, but anyway, of becoming an officer, you were allowed to have a few personal belongings, and I did manage to have a rod around. I was assigned to the very last thing I expected. You know, it was in the military police because I'd asked for infantry. There were black troops and white troops, and black troops had white officers. I mean, it's no longer that way in the Army, but it was a very unjust thing. And I served with a black military police battalion, both in the U.S., and we went off to North Africa together. They were a super bunch of guys. As a matter of fact, I helped them to achieve a singular honor, which was to be the only VD-less unit in the North African Theater of Operations, by my running along with my sergeant a small but very efficient whorehouse.
that was quite an achievement. How did you happen to become a guest of the Bosch?
Among my duties in North Africa was guarding a number of different military installations, and one of them, which I went to check my, was in more frequently than the others because the food was so good. They had a French chef. Turned out to be an OSS training camp. I didn't know it was an OSS training camp, but I knew the food was awfully good, and I asked how could one get in that outfit, and they said, well, you have to volunteer. I said, I volunteer. And after, you know, security checks and stuff, I suddenly was in OSS and teaching at that school, and after a little bit, somebody said, how would you like to go on a mission? I said, gee, sounds great. So I ended up going on a mission. Naturally, I took my rod with me because it would be unseemly somehow to drop into France without one, since there was very good trout fishing, presumably, in the area we were going. And as things turned out, I did manage to get a little fishing.
Well, what happened?
Well, somehow, despite this, we managed to win the war. And I landed safely with the rod. We were busy doing the things we were supposed to do for quite a spell, and then there was a hiatus in activities. And I managed to squeeze in a day fishing in a stream that was near a place that we called our hideout. And I had to climb down into a deep canyon, and it was between two railway tunnels, which had been, which no longer had traffic going through them. So I didn't expect any problems of any kind. I was fishing in uniform, fortunately not with a cap, and I had a shoulder holster, but it was under my shirt. I had an American flag on one arm, and all of a sudden, while I was caught up in the fancy that there was no war, that I was, maybe out in Yellowstone Park or something, having a wonderful time, I heard marching feet and looked up, and there was a German patrol walking down the track. Fortunately, they kept on walking. I didn't hook a fish, which would have been a bit. If I had hooked a fish, I was a bit frightened that these guys might have wanted to stop and talk about it or something, and I really wasn't in any hurry to talk with these guys and to have them see an American flag, because it never occurred to them that anything as crazy as what I was doing could possibly have happened in any case.
You see the kind of trouble that you can get into through fishing?
Yeah, but, well, I got through it, so I guess all right.
Well, after you kind of drifted a little bit after the war, and I guess you decided to go back into the military, huh?
I met this absolutely gorgeous girl to whom I'm still married, and I couldn't persuade her to marry me until I I could prove an ability to pay the bills regularly. And unfortunately, the different things that I tried, none of them seemed to come up with a figure that, tying trout flies, for instance, apparently I spent too much time testing the product instead of selling and making it. And I ended up thinking that really the only trade where they would pay me a decent salary was back in the Army. So back in the Army I went.
And how long were you in the Army?
Oh, about four or five more years of active duty.
And then what happened? You went out west, I guess. So you wanted to be near fishing and hunting and this sort of thing, but also have an honest living. Huh?
Well, I thought the Army was an honest living, but I think I was starting to twitch before parachuting. You know, and twitch in the night. My wife would say, "Are you jumping tomorrow?" And I'd say, "Yes." "How did you know?" And she said, "You twitched." Well, I thought that, you know, maybe we've overdone this thing. I'd been involved in organizing special forces, so. Not having completed my education, the obvious thing for me to do was to sell something. And the most dignified thing that a person could sell is stocks. I mean, it depends. So when things are going up, it's dignified. When they're going down, you're a crook. But anyway, I got into the brokerage business in Portland, Oregon, and it was not a spectacular success.
Where are you living now?
I live in... about 5 miles north of Sun Valley, Idaho, which was my father's final resting place.
And you haven't packed up your fishing tackle by any stretch of the imagination?
No, no way.
I was reading an article, I clipped it out of the Post the other day, and this deals with the posthumous novel that your father wrote, The Garden of Eden, which did not get very good reviews.
Yeah, I haven't seen any reviews. I've read it.
Well, I saw a couple of reviews, and some of them said it would have been better not to have been printed, although there was a nice review in, believe it or not, Glamour magazine, which I was reading yesterday. But there was criticism for publishing the book, and according to Scribner's, Patrick and Jack were responsible for getting the manuscript out and printing it. What is this true? Estate, I imagine this is
yes,
the way it developed.
Right. My stepmother, represented by her lawyer, and my youngest brother and Patrick and I are the people who decide whether to or not. The request was made by Charlie Scribner to do it. He said that a good job. I didn't have a chance to read the unedited version. I was presented with the version as edited as it's being published. I was very impressed with it. I mean, these things are so much a question of what you feel about something. I thought that the story within the story is a gem. I thought that the transition of that with the other story is fabulously done. I was assured that the editing process involved no addition, no extension, and really only removal.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, it was wordy in the extreme, and in sort of wandering away from the theme. And the job that Tom Jenks did, talking to him, was essentially following the core of the story and eliminating the extraneous matter. I think this is probably a reflection. I don't know. I'm not a Hemingway scholar, despite being a Hemingway. But I suspect that my father's capacities were sometimes extremely lucid and then sometimes not in the last years, and this probably is why the story did need to have so much work done to it. I know from the point of view of how of whether these things should be published, any of the things, even the movable feast, for instance, he would not have permitted. I don't think he wanted the people some of whom felt that they were hurt by things said in it. I don't think he'd ever wanted it to be published. But I think that people in general have benefited from the opportunity to read his works. And I think the important thing is that they know that that they're not the work that Hemingway would have chosen to be judged on.
I think that's a very good point. The some of the critics who said the book probably would have been better left unpublished, in a way, are judging it by other standards. Whereas I think people who are fascinated by Hemingway would look at this early work and the Movable Feast as well from a historical standpoint, and to see his development and see the process that Hemingway used to write, even though the manuscript may have been flawed. It may not have been exactly what he would have wanted. But you mentioned you're not a Hemingway scholar, but there are a lot of Hemingway scholars and people who are just fascinated by Hemingway, and they want to read that. They want to know.
Well, I think, you know, the other thing is that in reading it, if you don't come to it with a preconception because of words you've heard about sexual aberrations or what have you, it reads well, and it holds your attention, and you want to know what's going to happen next. And and it's vintage Hemingway in the way the conversations are carried out and this sort of thing. I felt good about it. There were obviously, I think there were one or two phasings from one part to another that were a little tiny bit awkward. But in view of the rules that have been laid down for Tom Jenks, it was quite apparent that he could not do anything about those without having created something of his own. And since that wasn't within the covenant, I think it turned out marvelously.
Well, Jack Hemingway, in addition to producing Misadventures of a Fly Fisherman, you also produced three spectacular daughters. How are they getting along?
Well, my greatest accomplishment. You know, the funny thing, you know, the one who started the ball rolling was Margot. You know, she left the nest without permission. And before we could really catch up to where she was, she'd got herself to New York and was on the cover of Time with a $1 million contract. And, you know, what can you say then? Muffet, our oldest girl, who was back with us in Idaho, and super tennis player, a great cook, has written cookbooks, and Marielle, I think, is on her way to a spectacular acting career. And I'm awfully proud of those girls. I'm going to try to get them all together for a picture this evening.
Here in New York?
Yep.
Everybody's here in New York?
Yeah.
Well, that's you're here to promote the book.
Yes.
And do the other two girls live here in New York?
Margot and Marielle are both living in New York at present. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
my wife is the one who's really sad not to be here, but she wasn't well enough to come.
Well, Jack Hemingway, you're certainly an engaging guy. I enjoyed reading Misadventures of a Fly Fisherman, amused by your catches and sometimes the loss of them. And
it's not a fishing book, is it?
No. It's kind of hard to define, but no, it's not a fishing book as such. No, but it's an unusual approach to your story, and I enjoyed reading it. And I appreciate your coming in, and I want you to, they don't know me, but I want you to give my best to your three daughters.
I will.
Jack, anyway, thanks a lot.
Great pleasure for me. Thank you.
Hang on one second.